For a number of years, I was a partner in a small commercial laboratory in Monterey. Many strange things happened while we worked, and the following story, which I've called The Snake, happened almost exactly as I've written it. I don't know what it means. The story was finally published, and one of my favorite pieces of fan mail came from a small-town librarian. She said it was the worst story she had ever read anywhere. She was quite upset at its badness. Actually, it isn't a story at all. It's just something that happened, and it goes this way. Said it was almost dark when young Dr. Phillips swung his sack to his shoulder and left the tide pool. He climbed up over the rocks and squashed along the street in his rubber boots. The street lights were on by the time he arrived at his little commercial laboratory on Cannery Street of Monterey. It was a tight little building, standing partly on piers over the bay, and partly on the land. On both sides, the big corrugated iron sardine canneries crowded in on it. Dr. Phillips climbed the wooden steps, opened the door. The white rats in their cages scampered up and down the wire, and the captive cats in their pens mewed for milk. Dr. Phillips turned on the glaring light over the dissection table and dumped his clammy sack on the floor. He walked to the glass cages by the window where the rattlesnakes lived, leaned over and looked in. The snakes were bunched and resting in the corners of the cage, but every head was clear, and the dusty eyes seemed to look at nothing. But as the young man leaned over the cage, the forked tongues, black on the ends and pink behind, twittered out and waved slowly up and down, and then the snakes recognized the man and pulled in their tongues. Dr. Phillips threw off his leather coat, built a fire in the tin stove. He set a kettle of water on the stove and dropped a can of beans into the water. Then he stood staring at the sack on the floor. He was a slight young man with a mild, preoccupied eye as of one who looks through a microscope a great deal, and he wore a short, blonde beard. The draft ran breathily up the chimney, and a glow of warmth came from the stove. The little waves washed quietly among the piles under the building. Arranged on the shelves about the room were tier upon tier of museum jars, containing the mounted marine specimens the laboratory dealt in. Dr. Phillips opened a side door, went to his bedroom, a book-lined cell containing an army cot, a reading light, and an uncomfortable wooden chair. He pulled off his rubber boots and put on a pair of sheepskin slippers. When he came back to the other room, the water in the kettle was beginning to hum. He lifted his sack to the table under the white light and emptied out 2 dozen common starfish. These he laid out side by side on the table. His preoccupied eyes turned to the busy rats in the wire cages. Taking grain from a paper sack, he poured it into the feeding trough, and instantly the rats scrambled down from the wire and fell on the food. A bottle of milk stood on a glass shelf between 2 mounted octopi and a jellyfish. Dr. Phillips lifted down the milk, walked to the cat cage, but before he filled the containers, he reached in the cage and gently picked up a big, rangy alley cat. He stroked her for a moment and then dropped her in a small black-painted box, closed the lid and bolted it, and then turned on a petcock, which admitted gas, to the killing chamber. While the short, soft struggle went on in the black box, he filled the saucers with milk. One of the cats arched against his hand, and he smiled and petted her neck. The box was quiet now. He turned off the petcock, for the airtight box would be full of gas. On the stove, the pan of water was bubbling furiously about the can of beans. Dr. Phillips lifted out the can with a big pair of forceps, opened it, emptied the beans into a watch glass. While he ate, he looked at the starfish on the table. From between the rays, little drops of milky fluid were exuding. He bolted his beans, and when they were gone, he put the dish in the sink and stepped to the equipment cupboard. From this, he took a microscope and a pile of little glass dishes. He filled the dishes one by one with seawater from a tap and arranged them in a line beside the starfish. He took out his watch, laid it on the table under the pouring white light. The waves washed with little sighs against the piles under the floor. He took an eyedropper from a drawer and bent over the starfish. At that moment, there were quick, soft steps on the wooden stairs and a strong knocking at the door. A grimace of annoyance crossed the young man's face as he went to open. A tall, lean woman stood in the doorway. She was dressed in a severe suit. Her straight black hair, growing low on a flat forehead, was mussed as though the wind had been blowing it. Her black eyes glittered in the strong light. She spoke in a soft, throaty voice. "May I come in? I want to talk to you." "I'm very busy just now," he said half-heartedly. "I have things to do at times." And he stood away from the door. The tall woman slipped in. "I'll be quiet till you can talk to me." He closed the door then, brought the uncomfortable chair from the bedroom. "You see," he apologized, "the process has started and I've got to get to it. So many people wander in and ask questions, and I have to explain the common processes." He could tell them without thinking. "Sit here," he said. "In a few moments, I'll be able to listen to you." The tall woman leaned over the table. With the eyedropper, Dr. Phillips gathered fluid from between the rays of the starfish and squirted it into a bowl of the water, and then he drew some milky fluid and squirted it in the same bowl and stirred the water gently with the eyedropper. And he began his little tired patter of explanation. "When starfish are sexually mature, they release sperm and ova when they're exposed at low tide. By choosing mature specimens and taking them out of water, I give them a condition of low tide. Now I've mixed sperm and ova. Now I put some of the mixture in each of these 10 watch glasses. In 10 minutes, I will kill the first with menthol. 20 minutes later, I will kill the second. Then a new group every 20 minutes. When I have finished, I will have arrested the process in stages, and I will mount the series on microscope slides for biologic study." He paused. "Would you like to look at this group under the microscope?" "No, thank you," she said. He turned quickly to her. People always wanted to look through the glass. She wasn't looking at the table at all, but at him. Her black eyes were on him, but they didn't seem to see him. He realized why the irises were as dark as the pupils. There was no color line between the two. Dr. Phillips was piqued at her answer, although answering questions bored him. A lack of interest in what he was doing irritated him. He wanted to arouse her. "While I'm waiting the first 10 minutes, I have something to do. Some people don't like to see it. Maybe you'd better step into that room till I finish." "No," she said in her soft, flat tone. "Do what you wish. I'll wait until you can talk to me." Her hands rested side by side on her lap. She was completely at rest. Her eyes were bright, but the rest of her was almost in a state of suspended animation. He thought, low metabolic rate, almost as low as a frog's from the looks. And the desire to shock her out of her inanition possessed him again. He brought a little wooden cradle to the table, laid out scalpels and scissors, and rigged a big hollow needle to a pressure tube. Then from the killing chamber he brought the limp dead cat, laid it on the cradle, and tied its legs to the hooks on the sides. He glanced sideways at the woman. She had not moved. She was still at rest. The cat grinned into the light. Its pink tongue stuck out between its needle teeth. Dr. Phillip deftly snipped open the skin at the throat. With a scalpel, he cut through and found an artery. With flawless technique, he put the needle in the vessel, tied it with gut. "Embalming fluid," he explained. "Later I'll inject yellow mass into the venous system and red mass into the arterial system for bloodstream dissection. Low biology classes." He looked around at her again. Her dark eyes seemed veiled with dust. She looked without expression at the cat's open throat. Not a drop of blood had escaped. The incision was clean. Dr. Phillips looked at his watch. "It's time for the first group." He shook a few crystals of menthol into the first watch glass. The woman was making him very nervous. The rats climbed about on the wire of their cages and squeaked softly. The waves under the building beat with little shocks on the piles. The young man shivered. He put a few lumps of coal in the stove and sat down. "Now," he said, "I haven't anything to do for 20 minutes. He noticed how short her chin was between upper lip and point. She seemed to awaken slowly, to come out of some deep pool of consciousness. Her head raised and her dark, dusty eyes moved about the room and came back to him. "I was waiting," she said, and her hands remained side by side on her lap. "You have snakes?" "Why, yes," he said rather loudly. "I have 2 dozen rattlesnakes. I milk out the venom and send it to the anti-venom laboratories." She continued to look at him, but her eyes did not center on him. Rather, they covered him and seemed to see in a big circle all around him. "Have you a male snake, a male rattlesnake?" "Well, it just happens I know I have. I came in one morning and found a big snake in coition with a smaller one. That's very rare in captivity. You see, I do know I have a male snake." "Where is he?" "Why, right in the glass cage by the window there." Her head swung slowly around, but her two quiet hands did not move. She turned back to him. "May I see?" He got up and walked to the case by the window. In the sand bottom of the cage, the knot of rattlesnakes lay entwined, but their heads stuck out clear. The tongues came out, flicked a moment, and waved up and down, feeling the air for vibrations. Dr. Phillips nervously turned his head. The woman was standing beside him. He had not heard her get up from her chair. He had heard only the splash of water among the piles and the scampering of rats. She said softly, "Which is the snake you spoke of?" He pointed to a thick, dusty gray snake lying by itself in one corner of the cage. "That one. He's nearly 5 feet long. He comes from Texas. Our Pacific Coast snakes are usually smaller. He's been taking all the rats, too. When I want the others to eat, I have to take him out." The woman stared down at the blunt, dry head. The forked tongue slipped out and hung and quivered for a long moment. "And you're sure he's a male?" "Rattlesnakes are funny," he said glibly. "Nearly every generalization proves wrong. I don't like to say anything definite about rattlesnakes, but yes, I can assure you he's a male." Her eyes did not move from the flat head. "Will you sell him to me?" "Sell him," he said. "Sell him to you. You do sell specimens, don't you?" "Oh, yes, yes, of course I do. Of course I do. How much? $5? $10? "Oh, not more than $5. But do you know anything about rattlesnakes? You might be bitten." She looked at him for a moment. "I don't intend to take him. I want to leave him here, but I want him to be mine. I want to come here and look at him and feed him and know he's mine." She opened a little purse and took out a $5 bill. "Here, now he's mine." Dr. Phillips began to be afraid. "You could come in and look at him without owning him." "I want him to be mine," she said. "Oh, Lord," he cried, "I've forgotten the time," and he ran to the table. 3 minutes over. "It won't matter much," he said, and he shook menthol crystals into the second watch glass. And then he was drawn back to the cage, where the woman still stared at the snake. She asked, "What does he eat?" "I feed them white rats, rats from the cage over there." "Will you put him in the other cage? I want to feed him." "He doesn't need food. He's had a rat already this week. Sometimes they don't eat for 3 or 4 months. I had one that didn't eat for over a year." In her low monotone, she asked, "Will you sell me a rat?" He shrugged his shoulders. "I see. You want to watch how rattlesnakes eat. All right, I'll show you. The rat will cost 25 cents. It's better than a bullfight if you look at it one way, and it's simply a snake eating his dinner if you look at it another way." His tone had become acid. He hated people who made a sport of natural processes. He was not a sportsman. He could kill 1,000 animals for knowledge, but not an insect for pleasure. He'd been over this in his mind before. She turned her head slowly toward him, and the beginning of a smile formed on her thin lips. "I want to feed my snake," she said. "I'll put him in the other cage." She had opened the top of the cage and dipped her hand in before he knew what she was doing. He leaped forward and pulled her back, and the lid banged shut. "Haven't you any sense?" he said fiercely. "Maybe he wouldn't kill you, but he'd make you damn sick in spite of what I could do for you." "You put him in the other cage then," she said quietly. Dr. Phillips was shaken. He found that he was avoiding the dark eyes that didn't seem to look at anything. He felt it was profoundly wrong to put a rat into the cage, deeply sinful, and he didn't know why. Often he'd put rats in the cage when someone or other had wanted to see it, but this desire tonight sickened him. He tried to explain himself out of it. "It's a good thing to see," he said. "It shows you how a snake can work. It makes you have respect for a rattlesnake. Then, too, lots of people have dreams about the terror of snakes making the kill. I think because it is a subjective rat. The person is the rat. Once you see it, the whole matter is objective. The rat is only a rat, and the terror is removed." He took a long stick equipped with a leather noose from the wall, opened the trap, dropped the noose over the big snake's head, and tightened the thong. A piercing, dry rattle filled the room. The thick body writhed and slashed about the handle of the stick as he lifted the snake out and dropped it in the feeding cage. It stood ready to strike for a time, but the buzzing gradually ceased, and the snake crawled into a corner, made a big figure eight with its body, and lay still. "You see," Dr. Phillips explained, "these snakes are quite tame. I've had them a long time. I suppose I could handle them if I wanted to, but everyone who does handle rattlesnakes gets bitten sooner or later. I just don't want to take the chance." He glanced at the woman. He hated to put in the rat. She'd moved over in front of the new cage, and her black eyes were on the stony head of the snake again. She said, "Put in a rat." Reluctantly, he went to the rat cage. He was sorry for the rat, and such a feeling had never come to him before. His eyes went over the mass of swarming white bodies climbing up the screen. Which one, he thought, which one should it be? And suddenly he turned angrily to the woman. Wouldn't you rather I put in a cat than you see a real fight? A cat might even win. But if it did, it might kill the snake. I'll sell you a cat if you like. She didn't look at him, put in a rat. She said, I want to see him eat. He opened the rat cage and thrust his hand in, and his fingers found a tail. He lifted a plump, red-eyed rat out of the cage. It struggled up to try to bite his fingers, and failing, hung spread out and motionless from its tail. He walked quickly across the room, opened the feeding cage, and dropped the rat on the sand floor. Now watch it, he cried. The woman didn't answer. Her eyes were on the snake, where it lay still, its tongue flicking in and out rapidly, tasting the air of the cage. The rat landed on his feet, turned around, sniffed at its pink naked tail, and then unconcernedly trotted across the sand, smelling as it went. The room was silent. Dr. Phillips did not know whether the water sighed among the piles or whether the woman sighed. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw her body crouch and stiffen. The snake moved out smoothly, slowly. The tongue flicked in and out. The motion was so gradual, so smooth, that it didn't seem to be motion at all. In the other end of the cage, the rat perked up a little in a sitting position and began to lick down the fine white hair on his chest. The snake moved on, keeping always an S-curve in its neck. The silence beat on the young man. He felt the blood drifting up in his body. He said loudly, see, he keeps the striking curve ready. Rattlesnakes are cautious, almost cowardly. The mechanism is so delicate. The snake's dinner is to be got by an operation as deft as a surgeon's job. He takes no chances with his instruments. The snake had flowed to the middle of the cage by now. The rat looked up and saw the snake and then unconcernedly went back to licking its chest. It's the most beautiful thing in the world, the young man said, and his veins were throbbing. It's the most terrible thing in the world. The snake was very close now, its head lifted a few inches from the sand. The head weaved slowly back and forth, aiming, getting distance, and aiming. Dr. Phillips glanced again at the woman, and he turned sick, for she was weaving too, or just slightly weaving. The rat looked up and saw the snake. It dropped on 4 feet and backed up, and then the stroke. It was impossible to see, simply a flash. The rat jarred as though under an invisible blow. The snake backed hurriedly away into the corner from which it had come and settled down, its tongue working constantly. Perfect, Dr. Phillips cried, right between the shoulder blades. The fang must almost have reached the heart. Now the rat stood still, breathing like a little white bellows. And suddenly it leaped in the air and landed on its side, and its legs kicked spasmodically a second, and it was dead. The woman relaxed sleepily. Well, the young man demanded, it was an emotional bath, wasn't it? She turned her dusty eyes to him. Will he eat it now, she asked. Of course he'll eat it. He didn't kill it for a thrill. He killed it because he was hungry. The corners of the woman's mouth turned up a trifle again, and she looked at the snake. I want to see him eat it. Now the snake came out of its corner again. There was no striking curve in its neck, but it approached the rat gingerly, ready to jump back in case it attacked. It nudged the body gently with its blunt nose and drew away. Finally, satisfied that it was dead, the snake touched the body all over with his chin, from head to tail. It seemed to measure the body and to kiss it. Finally, it opened its mouth and unhinged its jaws at the corners. Dr. Phillips put his will against his head to keep it from turning toward the woman. He thought, if she's opening her mouth, I'll be sick. I'll be afraid. And he succeeded in keeping his eyes away from her. The snake fitted its jaws over the rat's head and then, with a slow peristaltic pulsing, began to engulf the rat. The jaws gripped and the whole throat crawled up and the jaws gripped again. Dr. Phillips turned away and went to his work table. You've made me miss one of the series, he said bitterly. The set won't be complete. He put the watch glasses under the low-power microscope and looked at it. And then angrily he poured the contents of all the dishes in the sink. The waves had fallen so that only a wet whisper came up from the floor. The young man lifted a trap door at his feet and dropped the starfish down into the black water. He paused at the cat, crucified on the cradle, and grinning comically into the light. His body was puffed with embalming fluid. He shut off the pressure, withdrew the needle, and tied the vein. "Would you like some coffee?" he asked. "No, thank you. I shall be going pretty soon." He walked to her, where she stood in front of the snake cage. The rat was swallowed, all except an inch of pink tail that stuck out of the snake's mouth like a sardonic tongue. The throat heaved again, and the tail disappeared. The jaws snapped back in their sockets, and the big snake crawled heavily into a corner, made a big figure eight, and dropped its head on the sand. "He's asleep now," the woman said. "I'm going now. But I'll come back, and I'll feed my snake every little while. I'll pay for the rats. I want him to have plenty. Sometime I'll take him away with me." Her eyes came out of their dusty dream for a moment. "Remember, he's mine. Don't take his poison. I want him to have it. Good night." She walked swiftly to the door and went out. He heard her footsteps on the stairs, but he could not hear her walk away on the pavement. Dr. Phillips turned a chair around and sat down in front of the snake cage. He tried to comb out his thought as he looked at the torpid snake. "I've read so much about psychological sex symbols," he thought. "It doesn't seem to explain. Maybe I'm too much alone. Maybe I should kill the snake. If I knew... No, I can't pray to anything." For weeks he expected her to return. "I'll go out and leave her alone when she comes back," he decided. "I won't see that damn thing again." But she never came again. For months he looked for her when he walked about in the town. Several times he ran after a tall woman, thinking it might be she, but he never saw her again, ever.